Hi, you're listening to Sentinel Watch. I'm David Brown. So let me throw something out there and just see if this rings a bell, okay? You're driving through your neighborhood and you see a sign in someone's yard, a political sign. Unreal, you think. It's one of those signs for that politician. The one with those disgusting policies, the one that says those things online, the one who seems to be in it for themselves. In fact, that politician so reprehensible, you shudder to think what would possess someone to support that person in the first place. They must be as reprehensible. How could someone support a politician like that? How could you ever talk to them again? Does any of this ring a bell? Joining us now is the editor of one of the most prestigious news organizations in the United States. The Christian Science Monitor is a Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper. And Mark Sappenfield is editor of the Monitor. Mark, welcome to Sentinel Watch.
Thank you for having me.
What I said there, does that sound familiar at all? I know you've been covering the story of what so many have been talking about, the seemingly deepening partisan divide in the U.S. for so long.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you see that everyone talks about is that this era is really characterized by what's called negative partisanship, which is almost hating the other side more than liking your side. So that's very consistent with what we see going on politically.
Right now, there's a lot in the media about how political tensions on both sides have reached such a pitch in America that longtime friends aren't talking to each other. Sometimes families are even being torn apart by political arguments. Is that what you're seeing as you look at the American landscape right now?
I mean, you see it just even within the Monitor family, too. I mean, the Monitor, as a publication that has prided itself on being fair and putting those values very high, means it has a readership traditionally that has spanned, you know, progressive and liberal and conservative and all those different parts of the spectrum. And so there's a Monitor family too, and the Monitor family is very much one that goes across. And so you see it just in conversations, you see it in letters that we receive, is that it's a tough time and people are having a tough time finding that common ground.
So as editor of the Monitor, I mean, I would think that even before you get to the news, you have to address those issues up front. How do you go about it?
To me, it's really important in addressing these things to start from the foundation that the newspaper was begun. It was begun by Mary Baker Eddy, who also founded Christian Science. And really the founding principle was consistent with a lot of things she did, which was the importance of spiritualizing thought. And, you know, so many of us believe in, understand, have a conviction of some spiritual essence, some spiritual part of ourselves. But what Mrs. Eddy really did was push the boundaries on the relevance of that, the practicality of that. Is spiritual existence, spiritual understanding, something that is a nice to have or is it necessary? Does it drive the forces and the things that we see in the universe, or do we kind of put it aside because it's not practical and we'll just pull it out at times when, you know, we're in church or we're praying around the dinner table or something like that? And the whole reason, in my understanding, that Mrs. Eddy founded the Christian Science Monitor was to say, no, that spirituality is vital and essential and is a driving force, the driving force in our lives. And so kind of getting yourselves right for me as the Monitor editor means spiritualizing your thought around the things that you see. And that oftentimes means you see something different, because that's just the nature of spiritualizing thought, is the picture in front of you ends up being, if not wrong, then an incomplete picture of the fuller scene that you get when you look through the lens of spirit.
Mark, you know, I know that there are probably people who listen to this podcast and they may not know what spiritualizing thought means, or it may sound sort of out there, like too ephemeral. You know, it's like, I don't know what spiritualizing thought is. I know that I'm angry.
Yes.
Or right? I mean, they're those raw feelings. What would you tell them if they were sitting there across the table from you about how they can go about seeing things in a different way without just kind of pushing it to the side or ignoring it, or, you know, because no one wants to feel like they're sort of ignoring what they're seeing as the truth.
The things that really matter in life are all spiritual. You know, the connections that we make with friends and family, it's not because of their physical qualities. It's because of who they are and the way that they make us feel. So much of what ends up being, to my mind, real about our experience are the internal things, are the feels, are the things that go beyond just what the senses can see to deeper emotions. The most obvious is, of course, love. And love, of course, being so much more than just a romantic love, but this force that really binds us and gives us meaning and purpose. And you can go down the list of different things, you know, justice. Justice can be a physical thing that is dispensed by a court, but it's also a sense of belonging, a sense of having a place, being seen, being understood, being valued. All these things that we see that we often think about in physical terms actually, to me, have a spiritual essence behind them. And spiritualizing thought is saying, I'm not going to get hung up on the physical picture. I'm going to focus on the spiritual essence that are behind these things and realize that's the real substance of what's going on here.
Let me put it to you this way. I mean, if someone else is sitting around the table with us here, how do you talk to that person if, say, they won't talk to you? How do you spiritualize your thought there in that moment, which it seems to me is one of the challenges that we currently face, given the divide that seems to be separating us?
One of the things that you find when you look into how we talk to each other, and this goes beyond the current political context to talk about how we talk to each other as human beings,
right,
is there can be something called the backlash effect. And the backlash effect happens when you believe one thing and I believe another thing, and I try and use words and I try and use my intellectual capacity to convince you that you are wrong and I am right.
Uh-huh.
Science has found, or surveys have found over and over again, that the facts matter very little in that scenario. What happens is a backlash effect. And if I try and tell you you're wrong, the general tendency is to disagree and, if anything, to harden in your stance that I am wrong. But there is a way through that they find, and that's by finding shared values. So take, for example, something that can be divisive like climate change. If I try and show you all these scientific studies, data that suggest climate change is severely induced by human activity, you can then, as we see happen, find your own theories and data and studies and say, hey, but what about this? And you could just provide study after study after study after study that says climate change is significantly linked to human activity. But yet, a lot of people just don't believe it. They don't see it because the backlash effect is happening there. But if you say, look at the floods that have been happening in our community, how can we get together to address that? There's a shared value there. There's a shared value that both sides understand and can begin to have a conversation around. That might not be the best example, but it speaks to the idea that when you get beyond simply trying to litigate an issue and get to the ideas behind them, which I would suggest, again, what you're talking about is spiritualizing the debate. When you get to the values behind them, all of a sudden there's a permeability that didn't exist there before. One, because I think there's a sense of respect that is involved with that. You're seeing the other person rather than just shutting them off and saying, you're wrong, you're wrong. You're trying to find something in common between you. And if it can't be the physical facts, then to me, again, it could be the spiritual values that we share, the compassion, the love, the responsibility, the justice, all of these things we want. And we can find common ground in trying to seek them. And so if it doesn't work to kind of talk at someone, talk with them and find out who they are and what they value. And undoubtedly, there's going to be something that they value that you value too. And you can start there at least. It's not like poof, you know, it already happens and in 5 minutes it's done. But you can at least start to get a toehold on a conversation that maybe can build over time.
Well, you're saying so much here that it seems to resonate certainly with aspects of democracy which require us to talk, you know, which require consensus.
Yes.
And the only
yes.
way that you can get there is for there to be conversations. But there's something else that you seem to be suggesting, and that is that built into this whole narrative that we've been discussing, there's this idea that we are developing into camps where there is one truth and another truth, or multiple variations of the truth. And one looks across the aisle and says, that's a lie, and they're liars. And so does the other side, of course. In a sense, it seems to me that if you're going to assert that there is a way beyond this, right? You've got to get to a point where you agree on at least this much. There is a truth. What is truth to you as a journalist? What does that truth mean?
To kind of go back to the original part of the question that you asked, is us dividing into camps. And one thing that's pretty much irrefutable is that that's an integral part of the species known as human beings, is that we divide into camps, and we have done so through recorded history. You know, if you go back to prehistory, it's a very natural thing. You go into groups to protect yourself. You go into groups to provide a sense of support for one another. So we just naturally go into certain groups. So democracy doesn't force us out of groups. What democracy does is it holds things steady so that we can work through these things. It is telling that, you know, what did our founding fathers, when they founded our democratic republic, what did they say? They said, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. And it's exactly like you say, David, is that out of those tribes, democracy forces us to try and find some practical sense of oneness, trying to litigate the facts. You can't just make up stuff based on evidence of what you see. You have to go out and build your facts based on observing, on reporting, on all of those things that are just part of journalism 101. But I think the unique element that Mary Baker Eddy added to the Monitor is that spiritual facts are a part of that, and that we look for the spiritual facts, not just the material facts. In some ways, I would say the material facts we see as the outcome of the spiritual facts. And what are the spiritual facts? The spiritual facts are these things we've been talking about, is where is love operating today? Where is justice operating today? Where is responsibility operating today? You can go down the list of all these qualities that I would define as spiritual. And you can say, how are these things operating? And we struggle over them. Different human societies, different groups and tribes, as you say, might see responsibility and love differently from another tribe. So there can be strife, there can be tension. But I think the course of human history suggests that we do get better at this as we do it. And I think as we work at it, we can see some sense of progress.
You know, it's interesting. I'm also interested in this idea that you've sort of been hinting at when you talk about the spiritualization of thinking around these issues, that ultimately, as a journalist, you're in search of that truth, which is, in a sense, it's a kind of a statement, a stand, that there is truth. In other words, that there's not a multiplicity of truths. And it would seem to me that maybe that's a place where you can get a toehold in as a journalist, but maybe as someone who consumes the news, as so many of us do these days.
Yeah, and I think part of that we see that goes to good news values in terms of being a good news reader, but also being a good human being and growing as a human being, is do we read the news expecting to hear what we want to hear? Or do we read the news to be challenged? And I think that's a good rule of thumb for life, is that if we're going through life simply to have things be the way that makes us comfortable or be what we expect, that's not where progress comes from. That's not where growth comes from. And so I think part of it is being willing to make ourselves vulnerable enough in order to have humility, have grace, and grow and admit that we were wrong and that we can move forward. I had a great conversation with our congressional correspondent today. She was in the Capitol on January 6th. That was actually her first week on the job, which was, you know, hello, welcome to the job. So, in conjunction with our January 6th issue of the Christian Science Monitor Daily, I just talked with her for a small introductory piece that I wrote and really asked her, you know, what did you learn from being there? What have you learned from being in Congress in the year since then? There were three qualities that she says have really come to the fore, is that the journalism that she feels like the world really needs is driven by self-knowledge, by humility, and by love. And those are a progressive thing in the sense of one leading to the other, an iterative thing. The self-knowledge is you have to be willing to really examine yourself and be willing to say, am I wrong? Am I right? Am I open? Am I listening? The humility then that grounds that and gives it purpose and gives it practicality. And then the love that is the expression of those two things. And it just feels to me like when you talk about being a truth and how do you find that as a journalist? Those are really essential qualities. Whatever truth is, you aren't going to find it unless you express those qualities, I'm convinced.
You know, we've been talking a little bit about the relationships between individuals, and I think that there are some listeners who say, well, you know, then there are the policies themselves. I mean, the levels of disinformation that can seem so pernicious to notions of fairness and even standards of good government, and that those fears have led many to conclude that democracy itself may be at risk. I mean, we're talking on January 6th, 2022, a date in which we've seen a lot of commentary, certainly in the media, about whether we are headed into a civil war and the levels of acceptance of violence and that sort of thing. But it seems to me that in a sense, we are talking about a fear. What is the fear? Is it that government is not capable of governing itself, that truth is not sufficient? How do you see that?
Well, I think the fear is basically the collapse of the American ideal. And I think both sides see that manifesting itself in different ways. Mm-hmm. And both sides see the other side as complicit in bringing it about. And so therefore, each side is growing increasingly strident in their desire to prevent the other side from bringing this about. This is why the issue of facts becomes so fraught, is that each side finds the things that they care about,
right,
that they see as being at stake.
And I wonder if that hints at, again, if we're trying to think about how to spiritualize thought here, maybe we need to think about our perspective when it comes to the root of those fears, and that the manifestation of what we see in government today is, in its own way, a kind of a false statement about the nature of government itself, perhaps.
Well, I mean, I have a fairly radical view on this, in the sense that, because obviously my broken record is spiritualization of thought, because of kind of the work I've done in doing that, I have a very strong conviction that so much of the problems that we run into with government is when we think it is a thing outside of ourselves. And I know that can sound like a crazy thing, because, you know, here I am in Boston and I'm not in Washington. And, you know, how can a person, unless you have a dictator, how can a person encompass a government? But to me, as I understand it, in my understanding of God and spirit, is that there's one law and there's one God and there's one spirit. It's one thing. And that cannot be subdivided. That cannot be overturned. That if you to understand and to really wrestle with what does it mean to have one good God, and then to say, well, then what are we seeing here? How can this all be happening? It comes back to the degree to which our government expresses those qualities. And here I come back to the qualities again, but I'm saying this because this is something that I really have kind of come to after struggling for a long time with this, is that those qualities that are the qualities of one infinite God good, mm-hmm, are operating. They are present. And what we really want our government to do is to express them. That is the job of a government. The job of a government, the laws and all things that they pass, those are important effects. But the cause of the government is to express those good, what I would call divine qualities. And as a government, the proportion to which a government expresses those qualities is the degree to which it is successful, because it's nearing the actual expression of the one God. God has never given his power to United States, Russia, China, Germany, any of those places. It's not like God said, here, now you take over. That never happened.
Right.
So the issue here is, to what degree can our governments begin to reflect and express the power of God that is present and active now? And the problem is, when we run into these tribal things like you're talking about, then we start trying to split it up. You know, we do see it like a carcass at the watering hole that two lions are trying to pull apart. But that's not what government is. Government is expressed. And recognizing that, the government really becomes one of us demanding of ourselves that we express that government, that divine government, and then holding ourselves and others to that standard, not in a judgmental way, but saying, this is what I want expressed. In the government, the actual laws that are expressed are less important than the motives behind them and what they seek to do in terms of expressing good. it's a shift in how we see government. We're so used to looking at government and saying, did it do what I want it to do?
Right.
But can we look at government and say, did it do good today? And if so, how? How can I expand that?
You know, one of the reasons that I'm smiling as you say this is because I've heard arguments about, you know, the value of democracy is in a sense that we all play a role and we have a responsibility.
Yes.
In a democracy. But what you're suggesting is that we have, it's not, our responsibility goes beyond just say going to the ballot box or expressing ourselves, right? 100%. We have to, as you use the word radically, we have to radically spiritualize our approach, how we understand government. That's part of, in a sense, our responsibility and a way that we can actually improve.
There's this line in the book of Revelation in the Bible that says that when we reach the point of our understanding, we all become priests and kings. And I actually find that democracy is a progressive human step toward our realization of that divine fact. What we are seeing now is that there is a demand for us to express that. We can't just be all about ourselves. We can't just all be about government needs to do what I want it to do or I'm going to be upset. That's not a true sense of government. That's not God operating. That's not divine qualities operating. We need government to express the qualities of God. And therefore, it needs to be the expression of our expression. Mm. Government is not a separate thing. Government is the sum total of our actions. And so therefore, what we do is government. And our human government is the collective expression of that. I mean, governments have done well when they've been basically homogenous and it's been one tribe who's controlled it and everything was hunky-dory because that was that tribe. But it's like democracies are teetering and failing now because we are being forced to expand our sense of love. And we're not doing so well right now. But I think what we're going to find is that democracy is actually an expression of love. And when we turn democracy from being about getting what I want from a policy into here is how I'm going to express love collectively today, I think we will have moved a quantum leap forward in our understanding of government. And also our government will be a lot happier with the government we get.
You know, one of the beautiful things about the Christian Science Monitor, among the fact that, you know, of course, it's a Pulitzer Prize winning news organization, and it has a storied history going back to the early 1900s. And yeah, its form has changed. You're no longer publishing the broadsheet and that sort of thing. But its reason for being hasn't changed one bit. I mean, from the very beginning, it's been guided by this idea that when you break it down, you're trying as a journalist to injure no one in the search for truth. And in so doing, let the truth bring comfort and insight that helps everyone. Everyone.
Yes.
Right. So let's apply that to this situation right now. If we want to see this situation on this year anniversary of what many have described in terms of the manifestation of a kind of cataclysm, let's pull back and let's try to understand the truth. How do you define it? How do you see it?
Yeah, I keep coming back to, there was an article that I read, it was in the Guardian newspaper, and it was an interview with Diane Nash, who was a civil rights activist. Mm-hmm. And in that, she called nonviolence the single most important invention of the 20th century. I've written about this. Some of your listeners who read the Monitor might have read columns that I've written on this point. I find that a very profound statement. If you consider all the things that were invented, think about the 20th century. I mean, plane flight was invented, space flight, the internet, computers, home appliances. You know, it's like the inventions of the 20th, you could argue, I think it would be hard not to argue that more inventions of more importance happened in the 20th century than any other time in human history. And she says the most important invention of the 20th century is nonviolence. And I tend to agree with her. And the reason I bring that up in the context of this conversation is nonviolence leads us to what true government is. Nonviolence, she spoke about the work that she did with Dr. Martin Luther King. And when you read books of his or sermons of his collected in a book like Strength to Love, what you realize is that for Dr. King, for Mohandas Gandhi, for those who pioneered nonviolence, the actual act of being physically nonviolent is not the point. if you are walking around steamed and ticked off and just choosing to not be violent, you're not being nonviolent. I mean, Dr. King would say, there's the door. Bye. I mean, the name of the book is The Strength to Love. Nonviolence is about recognizing and following no other power but love. It says, I believe that love is the most powerful force in the universe, and I will live my life consistent with that conviction. That is incredibly radical. And my feeling is that we're not going to get out of this until we recognize the power of love. And again, that can sound so trite, but it's not. It's deeply profound and asks so much of all of us. One of my friends, he's a Christian Science practitioner, which is someone who helps people pray when they're needing help. He has a phrase that he uses. He says, there is nothing to deal with outside of the precinct of your own thought. That's a very nonviolent way of thinking about it.
Say that one more time.
There is nothing really to deal with outside of the precinct of your own thought. And I just was thinking about this today. In specifically that word precinct. You know, precinct is something that we in America attribute or associate with policing. You have police precincts. And in some ways, nonviolence was the active policing of our mental state. And I think specifically, I mean, obviously as a country right now, America is also dealing with a lot of issues of policing and race. And I mean, that's something to think about in that context too. Let's take it higher. Let's take it to a spiritual level as opposed to fighting it out over the scraps, over the carcass around the watering hole.
You've been awfully generous with your time and on a very busy news day to boot, Mark. And I really appreciate you doing that. But I want to leave listeners with a sense of, you know, a feeling that they know which way to turn and what to be looking for. And part of obviously the mission is to help us watch for those things that we need to be on the alert for. And I'm curious, if someone were to say, okay, do you feel optimistic? And if so, why? What would you say to them?
I would say that we have to follow divine law. And what I mean by that is, it seems to me that our democracy right now is out of joint and that we are focusing on the wrong things, not necessarily in terms of issues. You know, all the issues that we are talking about are very important issues and should not be minimized in terms of, it's not like I think there are simplistic answers. I think it's difficult precisely because there are no simplistic answers. If you look back to the founding fathers of the United States, they disagreed about everything. They could hardly agree on anything. But at some point they said, the importance of this democratic experiment we are undertaking is ultimately larger than our disagreements. And so therefore we must put our desire for the unity of this thing we are calling the United States above our differences. And at some point we are going to have to do that. And I believe we ultimately will, but we're not going to get there just by saying it. We're going to get there by having a change of heart that allows us to see each other with genuine love. Even if it doesn't need to be that we're all, you know, singing Kumbaya and hugging each other, but there has to be a shift from this, where you started this conversation, looking at the lawn sign and saying, oh my God, I hate this individual. A democracy can't survive in that scenario. That has to change. And so to the point is, we at the Monitor are trying to infuse our journalism with that deeper love, because we feel that for whatever the policies are, the only active way out is through that fuller expression of divine love, because that's the demand and it will be done. The question is just how quickly we do it and how we get there.
I was reflecting on the fact that I can think of many times in which it seemed that history was on an inexorable path to destruction. I mean,
yes.
You think of the Cold War, you know, and, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was part of that. You know, you think of what happened during World War II. You think of some of the darkest hours, in fact, in the 20th century, which saw so much change, as you were describing earlier.
Yeah.
And yet, a change of thought was what ultimately led to the change of conditions.
Yep. One thing that comes to mind with that is Mrs. Eddy had a really profound sense of what she meant by the word watch. And she talked many times about the importance of watching, and not watching like a passive sort of, I'm watching this person, but being on the watch, like being on the ramparts. And I think this is a moment for us to be on the watch as a country.
Mark Sappenfield is editor of the Christian Science Monitor. Mark, thanks so much for sharing your insights with us. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Sentinel Watch. I'm David Brown.
This podcast is produced and copyrighted by the Christian Science Publishing Society.